This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
In the morning, the police started firing tear gas at protesters who were waiting to be addressed by opposition leaders. That infuriated the protesters, resulting in them starting throwing stones and marching into the central district.
That's reporter Sebastian Mofu in Harare. We'll have full details on this story coming up. Also, Somali security forces say they have ended a deadly siege of a beachfront restaurant in the capital. The humanitarian organization Save the Children launches its own search and rescue ship to help save migrants and refugees crossing the Mediterranean. And the U.S. joins five European governments in urging members of Libya's House of Representatives to hold a vote within 10 days on a new cabinet in the capital. We'll have these stories and more, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story this hour, Somali security forces say they have ended a deadly siege of a restaurant on Lido Beach in the capital. At the scene, Mogadishu Police Chief Colonel Bashar told VOA seven people were killed, five civilians and two security officers. The attack occurred before dawn when a car bomb exploded and a gun battle began near the Banadir Beach restaurant. Bashar said police rescued most civilians stranded inside the restaurant building. He said police are in full control now. Al-Shabaab took credit for the attack. Lido Beach has recently become a popular site for new restaurants frequented by business people and members of the diaspora. The Turkish government recently opened the largest embassy in the world in the neighborhood. Opposition parties in Zimbabwe have vowed to hold more protests after police dispersed hundreds of protesters in the capital today. Police acted despite a high court order that barred them from interfering with demonstrators. Sebastian Nyofu has the story from Harare.
Harare's central business district turned into a battlefield between police and opposition supporters. The opposition had pledged the mother of all protests, but police started firing tear gas and water cannons before it even really started. Protesters started blocking roads. They set one market store on fire and they threw stones at police and people suspected to be supporters of the ruling ZANU-PF party. At one point, the water cannon vehicles ran out of water and had to leave for refuel. An opposition leader and former Prime Minister Morgan Tsvangirai said enough is enough.
We are in the season in which you don't know when it will evolve into what. But what I can assure you is that the people's anger is very deep. People's desperation is very deep. It must not relent. It must continue to express itself, the level of desperation that Zimbabweans are facing, so that we are able to solve this problem. It appears that when people succumb to fear and intimidation, people think that that's the end. But I'm very glad that Zimbabweans are beginning to say, no, enough is enough.
On the eve of the protest, Home Affairs Minister Ignatius Chombo said the police would not watch what he called foreign-funded protesters destroy Zimbabwe. The current wave of protests against the government began in July. The opposition says President Robert Mugabe must embark on democratic reforms and fix the country's moribund economy. They have also called on Southern African leaders currently meeting in Swaziland to look at the situation in Zimbabwe. On Friday, the embassies of Canada, Australia, and the United States issued statements separately calling for government to allow Zimbabweans to demonstrate peacefully. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
The The United States has joined five European governments in urging members of Libya's House of Representatives to hold a vote within 10 days on a new cabinet in the capital, Tripoli. The statement announced by the U.S. State Department today supports efforts by the UN-backed Presidency Council in the capital to reach agreement with a rival parliament in Tobruk in eastern Libya. France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and the United Kingdom joined Washington in endorsing the leadership of Prime Minister Fayez al-Sarraj and his Presidency Council to unite Libya under the government of national accord. Militias loyal to the new Tripoli government have received Western support, and U.S. airstrikes in efforts to retake the coastal city of Sirte that has been occupied by Islamic State forces for a year. Well, Tobruk challenged the Tripoli government on Monday with a vote of no confidence. Mr. Sarraj replied on Wednesday with an offer to shuffle his cabinet. He hopes to strengthen his Tripoli administration, unite the country, and drive Islamic State forces out of Libya. Experts have questioned the legitimacy of the vote in Tobruk and fear what more political resistance may mean to a country divided by 5 years of internal conflict. Mohammed Al-Shanawi asked Ambassador David Mack, former Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for the Near East and a scholar at the Middle East Institute, what the Tobruk vote means for the Libyan crisis.
It actually means that the current standoff in Libyan politics is likely to continue for a while. The parliament in Tobruk long since lost in actual practice its claim on legitimacy. It's never been able to meet with anything close to its full membership, and this vote was taken place on very short notice with less than a half of the members of the parliament present and able to vote. So I would not place too much significance on this particular vote, except for the fact that it does mean that we will continue to have a period of uncertainty about the political consensus in Libya behind some kind of government that would be able to effectively govern the whole country.
But some Libyan lawmakers believe the vote would ultimately dissolve the GNA. Others believe the vote requires the revamping of the entire Western-backed Presidency Council led by Fayez Sarraj, which would take the political process again back to square number one. Which scenario is more feasible in your opinion?
Well, I think the most likely outcome of this is going to be some minor changes in the cabinet that was set up by the Presidential Council. This would be done in order to gain greater support of some Libyan factions. It might mean reducing the size of the government, but it's certainly not going to mean that they start at square one, because whatever it's a lack of consensus, this government has been able to start up its operations. It's been able to coordinate a reasonably successful military effort against Daesh presence in Sirte, and it's beginning to gain a certain amount of traction.
The Western nations relied heavily on the GNA as the best hope for combating the Islamic State affiliate and curbing human trafficking from Libya. What is the alternative now?
You know, in the near term, I don't see an available alternative. The alternative that virtually all Libyans do not want to see is a continuation of these huge ungoverned spaces in the country, which can become breeding grounds for foreign, non-Libyan extremist groups, whether they are terrorists or criminal or engaged in trafficking of African migrants. I think that virtually all Libyan factions want to see that situation come to an end, nor do they want to see some kind of invasion by European powers that would, in effect, lead to perhaps a very temporary military solution to some of the current problems, but would just set in train all kinds of long-term problems. So I don't see another near-term alternative that is acceptable to anything like the overall Libyan body politic.
Final question, Ambassador Mack. What would this vote mean for the U.S. military involvement helping the GNA?
To the best of my understanding, the U.S. government is going to continue its military assistance to the current government of national accord. That is limited really to a combination of some on-ground advisory assistance and intelligence exchanges, as well as some air cover in certain situations where the Libyan forces require help from an air force, which, and their own air force is fairly weak, and so they might need some additional assistance there. There's also the possibility of supply of military equipment, the training that would be involved for them to effectively use that equipment.
That was Middle East scholar David Mack speaking with VOA's Mohammed Al-Shanawi about the Libyan political crisis. Break. So far this year, nearly 270,000 migrants and refugees have crossed the Mediterranean Sea to Europe, but many others never made it because their unsafe vessels capsized en route. Ships are patrolling the waters off North Africa trying to prevent more boat tragedies. And now the humanitarian organization Save the Children is launching its own search and rescue ship. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
Most of the migrants and refugees being smuggled across the Mediterranean leave from Libya, and they risk their lives doing so. More than 3,000 have drowned so far this year. The death toll is 40% higher than the same period a year ago. Sub-Saharan Africans make up the bulk of those making the sea journey to Italy, and more of them are children. Their numbers are up 2/3 over last year. Carolyn Miles is Save the Children CEO.
During this year, there's already been more than 15,000 children who have crossed over the Mediterranean into Italy. It's about 16% of the people traveling on that route. And most of those kids, about 90% of them, are doing this journey on their own without their parents.
Save the Children has been working at Italian ports for the past 8 years. But the Italian branch of the organization has been operating centers for migrant children for much longer.
When the kids first arrive, obviously you're really focused on first their physical needs. Are they physically okay? And making sure that they're, depending on the weather, that they're warm enough and that they've got water. Because a lot of times, again, depending on how long they've been on these boats, they can be dehydrated. But then also trying to address some of the psychological needs of children. So we try to do both of those pretty much immediately.
Most of the migrant children are traveling through Italy to other European countries where they have relatives. Asked why Save the Children decided to take part in the actual rescue of children at sea, Miles says,
it's really simple. We really have to stop kids from drowning. So that's why we've taken this step to add the rescue boat to the work that we're doing. It's going to be based out of Augusta, Italy, and it's going to have two smaller inflatable boats that are going to be operated by specialist rescue crews, and they will be literally saving people from capsized boats.
She says many migrants wear life jackets that would barely keep a small child afloat. The Save the Children rescue vessel will begin its patrols in September. It's capable of holding about 300 people.
We'll actually be working with the Italian Coast Guard. We'll be operating the rescue ship, but we'll be then transferring those people to the Coast Guard. Right now, I think the Coast Guard is doing fantastic work, but frankly, there's just too many people that are still making this really dangerous journey.
Miles says that a long-term plan is needed to tackle the causes of unsafe migration, including conflict, extreme poverty, human rights abuses, and climate change. She adds that stopping the smuggling gangs will not stop people fleeing for their lives. The Save the Children CEO says what's needed is greater investment in jobs and education in the migrants' home countries. In all, more than 283,000 migrants and refugees have entered Europe by both sea and land routes since the start of this year. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you, Joe. Well, as he mentioned in his report, more than 3,000 migrants and refugees have died so far this year trying to get to Europe. The International Organization for Migration says there should not be forgotten. Smugglers have developed new strategies of sending out large numbers of boats all at once. Some carry as many as 500 paying passengers. Julia Black is the director of the IOM's Missing Migrants Project. From Berlin, she spoke with VOA's David Arnold about what's changed in the deadly people smuggling business.
Not only have deaths increased on the Central Mediterranean route compared to last year, but they've increased despite the fact that arrivals in Italy have stayed the same. So that means that something has changed to increase these deaths that is not the number of people arriving.
And how do you explain this?
There are a couple of things. The Central Mediterranean route has always been pretty much the most dangerous crossing of the three Mediterranean routes. There's a number of reasons. First of all, because it's quite a bit longer just geographically than the eastern or western route. But the change that we've seen in the last year is due to new practices that smugglers use when bringing migrants across the Central Mediterranean. They're using a lot of really unseaworthy vessels. Quite often these are really large vessels with carrying hundreds of people. So that's quite different than what you see on the eastern or western Mediterranean route. In the past 6 months, we've also seen a lot more instances in which multiple boats carrying migrants departed from the Libyan coast at the same time. And that means that search and rescue operations are much more complicated. In addition, there's been an increase in departures from Egypt, and this is a much longer route than the departures from Libya and can take up to 10 days.
How many boats are these smugglers sending out at any given time?
The normal practice is that just one single boat is released, but when there's multiple boats, it can be 5 or 6 up to maybe 10 boats. But where it becomes especially complicated is when it's multiple boats carrying multiple hundreds of migrants on each boat. And then when there's shipwrecks or any other kind of mechanical troubles, then there's a huge need for search and rescue operations.
Can you talk about numbers in terms of some of these rescue operations, how many people died?
There's an alarming trend of hundreds of people, up to 500, 600, 700 people dying at one time in Central Mediterranean. Another thing that I find quite alarming is that there are a couple of instances, about 20 over the last 3 years, in which bodies of migrants have washed up to the shores of Libya without any reported people going missing, without any reported shipwrecks happening around the same time, which means it's possible that boats are disappearing in the Central Mediterranean that we never even hear about.
Those coming from Egypt, how much longer distance is that, and what are the risks when they take this longer trip?
In 2016, you've seen almost double the number of departures from Egypt, and this is, you know, just geographically farther away from Italy and Malta, where most of these migrants are headed. And that means that instead of a journey that takes 3, maybe 4 days, it can take up to 10 days. What's also a problem is that the coast of Egypt is not as well patrolled as the coast of Libya, and that means that when rescue operations are needed, they are often occurring farther away from land, and that means that there's a higher risk of people drowning and going missing and never being recovered at all.
What are the numbers of fatalities that you're encountering in this report?
In the first half of 2016, almost 3,000 migrants have died. We're now at more than 3,000. What's really remarkable about this number is that it's actually a 60% increase in the number of recorded deaths compared to the same period in 2015. That means the number of deaths that have occurred this year is much higher than last year.
Can you talk a little bit about who is involved in these efforts?
In the Central Mediterranean alone, this year, more than 100,000 migrants have been rescued, and about 4/5 of these rescues are conducted by national coast guards, mostly the Italian and Libyan coast guards. There are a huge number of very hardworking, very admirable NGOs working in rescue operations in the Mediterranean, and I believe in the Central Mediterranean alone, they have accounted for about 22,000 rescues this year.
You mentioned the Libyan Coast Guard. For 4 or 5 years, the country has been in real chaos.
I know that despite all the troubles that Libya is facing as a country, the Libyan Coast Guard continues to play a really vital role in rescuing migrants at sea this year.
That was Julia Black of the Missing Migrants Project in Berlin, speaking with VOA's David Arnold in Washington. Well, African heads of state and VIPs from around the world have converged on the Kenyan capital for the 6th Tokyo International Conference of African Development. A host of new trade and investment deals is expected. Lenny Rubaga has more from Nairobi.
This is the first time the Tokyo International Conference of African Development, TICAD, is being held in Africa. It is an historic occasion, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe told reporters in Nairobi Friday. Japan's government, along with the World Bank, the United Nations and the African Union, began hosting the TICAD in 1993. The conference is billed as a platform for high-level dialogue on policy. The list of attendees this year is full of VIPs. 37 African heads of state and the heads of the World Bank and the African Development Bank, to name a few. Lagging industrialization in Africa is on the agenda. Here's Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta on Friday.
We know that most nations which escape the grip of poverty do so by industrializing. Africa still has not lived up to its potential. We need to put our heads together to see how we can hasten the industrialization of the continent and how we can avoid the missteps of those who have previously walked this path.
The Japanese Prime Minister said Japan will be unveiling technology and training opportunities to foster growth at the conference. At the last TICAD in 2013, Japan pledged $32 billion in development aid to Africa. Some of it was earmarked for infrastructure development to encourage foreign investment. Japan is currently undertaking an expansion of the port of Mombasa to the tune of $250 million. Kenyan economic analyst Ali Kansachu of Rich Management spoke to VOA.
The Japanese have been heavily involved. That they're involved in our ports here in Mombasa, in Mozambique. They're doing a lot of the roads. They seem to me to have a strategy of basically around logistics and opening up the continent. And I think that's going to work well for them. What we have is a situation where the Indian Ocean is very much an appendage to the South China Sea. And I think Japan is seeking to counter China's influence not only in the South China Sea, but also in the Indian Ocean.
Duncan Ondu, a Nairobi-based sustainable development analyst, says he expects climate change and investment in agriculture to be hot topics this year.
One of the things which I think should be very tangible is greater commitment on issues of climate change, issues of food security, and how to be able to make Africans to be reliant in terms of food so that we don't have instances where there are pockets of hunger.
Around 10,000 delegates are here for the two-day conference, which wraps Sunday. Lenny Rovaga for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
When news breaks, VOA Africa is there. On weekends, tune into Nightline Africa at 1600 and 1800 UTC. And our five-minute newscasts come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.